Hi friends, welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where each week we share a Parsha idea on the weekly Parsha through the lens of ideas and incidents in Jewish history that I have culled from books and articles that I've come across over my Shabbos reads. Keep reading on Shabbos. The first time we encounter the land of Bavel is in our Parsha, in Parshas Noach. The Gemara in Zvachim, I think on Daf Kuf Yud Gimel, says that all of those who drowned in the flood eventually landed in the land of Bavel, which is like, it's a weird introduction, it's a strange introduction, an unexpected introduction to a land with such enduring associations with the Jewish people. Bavel, of course, is on the cover of every Gemara. The Talmud that we study across the world, across generations, is known as the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud. The name Bavel is literally on the front cover of our Talmud. So it's somewhat strange that we're first introduced to such an auspicious land in the context of such a harrowing story of the story of the flood of Noah. In fact, it doesn't really end there. The Medrash, and you can look it up, it's a really important Medrash, in Medrash Tanchuma Noach, Simon Gimel, number 3, which is probably one of the most cited midrashim in the works of Reb Tzadok HaKohen Melublin, the Hasidic master who animates so much of my own thought. In the Medrash Tanchuma, it spends much of our parsha talking about the virtues, the importance of Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral traditions that we have preserved in the Talmud Bavli. Kind of like the oceans of the flood, the Medrash explains, so is the vastness of Torah Sheba'al Peh, our oral Torah, the spoken traditions passed down throughout each generation. In fact, the Jewish people, according to the Medrash, they needed to be forced in that famous Gemara in Shabbos on Daf Peches, which says that God lifted up the mountain to force the Jewish people to accept the Torah, is specifically talking about Torah Sheba'al Peh. That's what the Jewish people, we don't know if we could handle this. We could handle Torah Shebichsav, the written Torah. It's got a beginning, a middle, and an end. But the oral Torah, specifically because it was so vast, so exacting, and requires so much individual effort and care, that's what the Jewish people needed to be forced into accepting. And all of these allusions come out in the Medrash Tanchuma on our Parsha, Parshas Noach. The allusions to Bavel become far more explicit as we continue reading the Parsha. Following the story of the Mabel, of the flood, we're introduced to Migdal Bavel, the Tower of Bavel, which begins in the beginning of the 11th chapter, Perek Yud Aleph. Everyone spoke one common language, and then all the people come together and they try to build a tower up to the heavens. It's a question, what exactly they were trying to do, seemingly to fight, to so to speak, to fight God. We don't need any midrashic allusions here. The Torah explicitly states that the very name Bavel derives from this story. The Pasuk says in Perek Yud Aleph, the 11th chapter, the 9th verse, Pasuk Tes, Al Kain Karashma Bavel. This is why we call it Bavel. What does the word Bavel mean? Kisham Balal Hashem Svas Kal Haaretz. It is here that HaKadosh Baruch Hu mixed up all of the languages of the world. So it's really interesting that on the cover of all of our Gemaras, and the value of these Gemaras, which is described in Medrash Tanchuma on Parshas Noach, all of the dead from the flood, all those who drowned are gathered in the land of Bavel, and the very name of Bavel enshrined on Gemaras throughout the world derives from our Parsha, from the word mixed up, that God mixed up everyone's language. And the question I want to think about is why here, why now? Reb Tzadok HaKohen Melublin, who we just mentioned, writes in his Sefer Yisrael Kedoshim, though he writes it in other places, but in Yisrael Kedoshim, Oz Zion, Reb Tzadok says that the first occurrence, the first time something mentions in the Torah, reveals its essence. So given like the enduring significance of Bavel, why is this our introduction? It's a strange time, a strange place, a strange context to find allusions for Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law. The Jewish people weren't even given the Torah yet. According to many, there were no Jewish people. So why is this the introduction to Bavel, the homeland of our Talmud, the origin of our Gemara? To understand all of this, I want to actually explore the significance of the year 1840, not the podcast, the calendaric year. It happens to be why I chose the name 1840 for our weekly podcast, but there is an incredible history behind the very year 1840 that I would like to talk about to really understand these questions, the connection between the introduction of the land of Bavel, Talmud Bavli, so to speak, and our Parsha. In the year 1840, the entire world began to shift. It was a year where modernity literally began to explode. Political modernity, economic, technological, social project literally upended traditional society. There is a phenomenal book that I read. It is not about Jewish history, but world history by Orlando Feiges. It talks a lot about the Jewish community. The book is called The Europeans, Three Lives in the Making of a Cosmopolitan Culture. And in that book, he points to the 1840s as creating a revolution in movement. The railway, he writes, enabled people across Europe to see themselves as Europeans. We're a part of something much larger rather than just our individual shtetl, community, even country. We're Europeans in a way that had not been done before. The telegraph, which was really brought to the public's attention in 1838, though it was kind of discovered and invented a few years prior, was arguably the greatest communications innovation since the printing press. The whole world could now communicate with one another. In her New York Times book review of the Europeans, Carolyn Weber emphasizes kind of the parallels between the 1840s and the moment we are in now. This is what she writes. Imagine a society where within the space of a single generation, human innovation all but collapses. The most formidable geographic distances, allowing individuals and information to travel the globe with unprecedented swiftness and ease. Where new platforms radically transform the ways in which news, music, books, and art are created and consumed, where media-driven celebrity trumps older modes of authority and forms new elite, endowing famous artists and performers with peerless cachet, where audiences converge in a worldwide culture of sharing and diversity and connectedness join equality and freedom as the shibboleths of Western liberalism, where at the same time legislation struggles to keep pace with technological change, capitalism, consumerism destroy even as they enrich, and nationalism, racism, xenophobia poison the public discourse, threatening disaster. If you had read that, you would think, what year, what period is she describing? You would have probably guessed, I don't know, that sounds like the time that we're in now, the mid-2000s. But in fact, she is talking about the 1840s. It was not just the secular world that began to shift. The religious world was transformed as well. There is a fantastic book by Dominic Green called The Religious Revolution, The Birth of Modern Spirituality, which focuses on the years 1848 to 1898. And it was really during this time in the 1840s where our contemporary conception of spirituality, that word, which, and I don't blame you right now if you're rolling your eyes. I am too, but that word, like being spiritual, I'm just spiritual. I'm not religious. I'm just spiritual. Where'd that spirit come from? He points to this religious revolution that began in the 1840s. This is what Dominic Green writes in the book. Suddenly, the heights of religious experience were no longer the privilege of hereditary male elites, nor was religious joy the meager fruit of renunciation, abstinence, or retreat. Like Napoleon, who wanted to conquer India but never went there, the modern individual seeks to combine West and East, rational and sublime, personal and collective, science and spirit, as Emerson exhorted Margaret Fuller, write your own Bible, this kind of individual spirituality that still kind of holds the world today. Now, this is what was going on in the 1840s in the wider world, both secular, economic, technological, and religious, but in the Jewish world, an even more radical revolution was brewing. Modernity eroded much of the traditional ties within the Jewish community. The Reform movement was emerging in the 1820s, the Habsburg Temple, but the 1840s kind of ushered in a self-conscious unity in a now splintered Jewish community. In February of 1840, the Jewish community of Damascus was accused of a blood libel. They were accused of murdering a Christian monk and using his blood to bake their matzahs, literally a classic blood libel. And for the first time, the worldwide Jewish community was galvanized for support. And in these 1840s, something very modern, what we take for granted, and then honestly the Jewish world is experiencing right now. I'm recording this, of course, in October of 2023, but reading these words is really incredible of how the self-conscious unity, we have ideological differences, we don't agree on so much, but we need to come together for a common cause. And this began in worldwide Jewry as a reaction to the Damascus affair. This is what Abraham Karp writes in his book, and I just want to give an extra shout out. This is a phenomenal book. book on American Jewish history, and I think one of the most accessible reads of early American history that really gave birth to the contemporary American Jewish community that we have now. That book is called Jewish Continuity in America, Creative Survival in a Free Society. And this is what he writes: participation in a common cause that so excited the emotions brought the scattered and disparate elements of the American Jewish community together in a communion of spirit and concern. It has been suggested that modern Jewish history dates from the Damascus Affair. Certainly, he writes, the American Jewish community had its beginnings as a self-conscious entity in the activity precipitated by the massacre in Damascus. Now, this is just scratching the surface, because 1840 is not just when Jewish communities are now coming together. 1840 has a very significant place on the Jewish calendar. 1840 on the Jewish calendar is the year 5600. That's the end of the 6th century of the 6th millennia. And the Zohar in Parshas Vayera on page 117, you can look it up. And if you subscribe to the Substack, I really try to include all of the links in the Substacks, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com. We try to send it out in the week, but if you like the audio, stick with the audio. Just giving that a quick plug, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com. If you subscribe to these, I have all the links to all the sources that I'm quoting and all the books, and you can look everything up there. But the Zohar writes, and this is really why we're talking about this, the Zohar actually writes, Uveshis mea shonen l'shisisa yiftachon tare dechachma le'ela mavoi dechachma le'tata. That's obviously in Zoharic Aramaic. I don't expect all of our listeners to understand that. But what the Zohar is saying, that in the 6th century of the 6th millennia, the gates of wisdom above and the wellsprings of wisdom below will open up. And the Zohar specifically makes reference, you can hear it in the imagery, the wellsprings, but the Zohar is explicit and says that this, I don't know, you want to call it a prophecy, this prediction of what's going to happen at the end of the 6th century of the 6th millennia, the year 1840, 5600 on the Jewish calendar, this is referring to Parshas Noach specifically. It evokes the imagery of the flood and specifically the life of Noach in the flood, that this is going to be the year of a messianic revolution. Now, obviously, messianic predictions rarely bring what they promise. So how did the Jewish community react to the seeming absence of the presence of Mashiach in the year 1840? Where was this wisdom? What exactly happened? There was this spirit. Something's going to happen, but what was it? So there is a fantastic article, very readable. I have it linked in the Substack, by Israel Bartel, called Messianism and Nationalism, Liberal Optimism versus Orthodox Anxiety. And he talks about how the Jewish community reacted to this Zohar based on the imagery of our Parsha, Parsha's Noach. How did the Jewish community react? So on the first hand, there was Orthodox anxiety. People in the traditional camp, most notably Rav Yaakov Lifshitz, who served as like the secretary, the right-hand person to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who was like the leading rabbi at the time. He was like one of those secretaries, I think my friend Ari Westreich once mentioned that the Aruch HaShulchan, Yechiel Michal Epstein, one time sent a letter to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector and said, look, I don't even know who's reading this letter. Is it you or is it your secretary, your right-hand person, Rav Yaakov Lifshitz? And Rav Yaakov Lifshitz was a really big scholar, the Talmud Chacham, but he also has a fantastic memoir. Just a quick shout out, if any of you read the American Yated Neman, Rav Pinny Lifshitz is his, I think, great-great-grandson. So this is a family that's been involved in Jewish leadership for quite some time. Rav Yaakov Lifshitz, in his memoir, Zichron Yaakov, cites this prediction of the Zohar, and, you know, obviously, Mashiach didn't come. We didn't really see anything happen, and he almost is frustrated because he blames it, so to speak, on the technological progress. The construction of railroads, steamships proliferated, the invention of matches, telegraphs, gas lights, electricity. But what did we see? We saw Jewish people leave tradition. So this is not a good thing. The beginning of the new age of technology, Bartel, again, who writes in this article called Messianism and Nationalism, Liberal Optimism versus Orthodox Anxiety. So he writes in this article, the beginning of the new age of technology, of which the author was well aware, referring to Rav Lifshitz, and which he associated in his book with the vast social and economic changes that took place in the Russian Empire during the second half of the 19th century, also marked the inception of the two great evils that would chart the course of the Jews in the modern age, the birth of Haskalah, enlightenment, people leaving tradition, and the rise of modern anti-Semitism. So he was not applauding whatever happened in 5600. Clearly, the Jewish people sinned. They went off, and whatever revelations we were supposed to receive obviously have been delayed. This was not a time for any standing ovations of any sort. More liberal thinkers, particularly in the Reform movement, Rabbi David Einhorn really embraced this idea that something's going to happen in 1840, and they were responding to what they saw as the progress of the human spirit and Jews' advancements towards, you know, their integration among the nations. We could have a redemption in diaspora. Finally, we can be accepted in Europe. And at one of the rabbinical conferences in Frankfurt and Breslau, Rabbi David Einhorn actually described Jews as a priestly nation with a messianic mission. And he later called for remaking the ninth of Av, which is usually a day of mourning. Let's turn it into a joyous festival. We can build a redemption over here in Germany. As he saw it, rather than a disaster, the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash is ushering in a new human spirit, God forbid, if I may say. But that's how they reacted on the other side. Now, there was somebody in between Rav Yaakov Lifshitz, and all three of these personalities are mentioned in Israel Bartel's article, between Rav Yaakov Lifshitz on the kind of the more traditional camp, the secretary of Yitzchak Inspector, David Einhorn, Gretz talks about this, Henrik Gretz, the famed historian, the dinner talks about this, but in between there is one figure who really could not ignore this anticipation, this excitement for what's going to come in the year 1840, and that is Rav Yehuda Alkalai. He was an outspoken Zionist and hoped the promises of the Zohar would materialize into the redemption of the Jewish people. He also weighed in on the Damascus affair. He realized that the bloodshed, hopefully that part of the prophecy that we have from our Nevi'im, that the Mashiach is going to come through bloodshed, would eventually transform into the celebrations of our ultimate redemption. He writes in his work Minchas Yehuda, again this is Rav Yehuda Alkalai, saying that he said that because the same prophecy speaks of the consolation of the land and the salvation of the blood and redemption of Israel, just as we merited that through your efforts to be saved from the blood libel, he's talking to philanthropists who stepped in after the Damascus affair, so we should also merit the consolation of the land and redemption of Israel. He was a lonely figure in a lot of ways. He was frustrated with his traditional colleagues. They should have placed, in his opinion, more hope in the redemptive potential of the year 5600, 1840, and he chastised Reform rabbinic leaders who looked towards redemption within the diaspora. Let's stay here. It's great in Europe. This is wonderful. Tisha B'Av could become a yontif, and they kind of ignored the redemptive possibility of actually moving to Eretz Yisrael. Still, and this has always moved me, his dreams did not go completely unheard and unfulfilled. He had a congregant, I believe his name was Shimon, who listened intently and we know historically purchased his work. This congregant would travel to his family and share the dreams of Rav Alkalai with his children and grandchildren. And his grandson was, of course, Theodor Herzl, one of the early pioneers, the early pioneer of the Jewish state of Israel, who perhaps, scholars debate this, hearing his grandfather come home from the shul of Rav Yehuda Alkalai and reading the works of Yehuda Alkalai, maybe this redemptive spirit, motivated him to be active and really push for a Jewish homeland. Which really brings us back to everything that our Parsha is about and why the spirit of Talmud Bavli seems to hover over all of Parshas Noach. There is an incredible idea from Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap, which he writes in his work, Mei Marom. He's one of the close students of Rav Kook, where he writes and he asks, it's crazy, how could the people of Migdal Bavel have ever imagined that they could go up to heaven and fight God? Like, what on earth were they thinking? And he says something really remarkable, that what gave them that idea, they sensed, he explained, the unfolding of Talmud Bavli, where in the Gemara we can argue with God and emerge victorious. As he writes, I'm going to read the Hebrew, Amnam chazu v'lo yadu ma chazu. They sensed something, they saw something, but didn't know what. V'chashvu mizeh, they thought from the idea that we know in the Gemara, and the Gemara in Bava Metzia, and Daf Pei Vav and Aleph, that God literally looks down from heaven at the Havayas, the Abayas, of Arava, the fightings and the oral battles that we have in interpreting and preserving our Torah from one generation to the next. And God looks down and says, Nitzchuni Banai, my children, you've defeated me. You've defeated me. We don't paskin based on what a prophet says, what God tells us directly. Jewish law, the oral Torah, is based on the collective spirit and debates of the Jewish people. It's not a prophecy. And they saw that v'chashvu mizeh ki notzer ba'olam makom kezeh seyesham rishus lehilacham ito b'shamayim chas v'shalom. And they got this idea from the spirit of Bavel, from the spirit of Talmud Bavli hovering over Bavel, that maybe we too can go ahead and wage a war against God. Obviously, that was in a heretical sense, but they felt that future presence of Talmud Bavli, where the Jewish people throughout the generations develop and decide the very spirit and definition of Torah itself. And this idea, the collective power and spirit of the Jewish people to, so to speak, conquer the divine, this underlies the messianic spirit of the entire parsha. One man, Noah, can rebuild worlds. This isn't about God building worlds. This is about humanity rebuilding a world after the flood. And this spirit ultimately resides in each of us and what we learn in our parsha. There is one Rav, one Rebbe, to be more precise, who we have not yet mentioned, who the year 1840 and 5600 has a very, very central role, and that is Rav Mordechai Yosef Liner of Ishbitz, known as the Ishbitzer Rebbe, the Mea Shiloach, the Rebbe, in fact, of Rav Tzadok HaKohen Melublin. Just parenthetically, Rav Tzadok himself, if you read his dreams, I believe his second dream points specifically to Parshas Noach as a generation that had the potential to actually receive the Torah, which probably plays into this idea of the Zohar, that Rav Tzadok writes that in his Divrei Chalomos, where he literally transcribes his dreams, one of the most fascinating works that you could read. But his Rebbe, Rav Mordechai Yosef of Ishbitz, began his Hasidic court specifically in the year 1840. He was a student of the Kutzke Rebbe, and on Simchas Torah, I believe of 1839, the year going into 1840, the year 5600, he left the school of Kutsk to start his own Hasidic school. We could talk about that debate a different time. And in his grandson's work, Rav Gershon Henoch Liner, which is called Sefer Shar HaEmuna V'Yesod HaChasidus, his grandson actually writes that it was specifically the spirit of this Zohar couched in Parshas Noach that motivated his beginning his own Hasidic court specifically in this year. He was 14 years in Kutsk, which he compares to when David HaMelech fled Shaul B'maris Adulam. You can look that up over here. It's really fascinating history about the Hasidic world of Ishbitz, and Ger Hasidus also hails from here. But in that year, 5600, 1840, this is what animated and motivated the Hasidic court of Ishbitz. But in Ishbitz, they interpreted it differently. For them, redemption was not about political emancipation and certainly not about diasporic, you know, freedom in Gullus in Europe. It was really about the capacity for each of us to see divinity and purpose within our own lives. In the words of Rav Gershon Henoch Liner, describing why his grandfather broke off and started his own Hasidic court in 1840-5600, he writes, that the words of Torah should become close and resonant within each of us, within each of our understanding and grasp. That there will be a spirit that everyone will suddenly realize, I need Torah within my life. I need that divinity, that spirituality, that the words of Torah will become near to everyone's grasp and understanding. And the redemption in these modern times begins from within each of us. Thank you so much for reading Jewish History in the Parsha. You can, of course, subscribe to our Substack, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com. Thank you, as always, to our sponsors, my dearest friend, Janet and Lior Hode and family. With immense gratitude to Hashem, I am so grateful for your partnership and friendship. Thank you all so much for listening, and keep reading every Shabbos.